Welcome to Tube Talk, the show dedicated to helping you become a better video creator so you can get more views, subscribers, and build your audience. Brought to you by vidIQ. Download for free at vidIQ.com.
Oh, yeah! Welcome back to another episode of Tube Talk presented by vidIQ. I am your host, Viper, the man about tech, executive producer of social media here at the IQ. And this week, I am taking the week off. I know. But here's the rub, you all. Recently, our very own Rob Wilson got a chance to sit down and talk with a very knowledgeable YouTube strategist named Mario Juve. And Mario has worked with some very big channels behind the scenes. Most notably, he used to be on the team with Mr. Beast. So this dude has acquired a lot of data as it relates to YouTube and how channels grow, and talking about titles, thumbnails, things that he has noticed as his time working behind the scenes. So I figured I will bring you guys some of the conversation that Rob had with Mario. We're going to break this up into two parts. So you'll get part one this week, and then you'll get the conclusion next week. But I think it's time we sit back and learn some of the deeper aspects of YouTube and how channels grow with Mario. So let's roll to the podcast.
Okay, so Mario, let's just jump straight into this. I always like to ask the first question. Imagine you're like a superhero. What's your origin story of Mario?
That's a good question to start off. My origin story is that I was this gamer guy on his computer, only in his room, and didn't know anything about the world. And then I discovered this thing called the YouTube algorithm. And that gave my life purpose and meaning. And now I'm on this quest to figure everything out about data and become the superhero that changes the world. That would be the fancy story.
And so in terms of YouTube, you've gone more towards the analytical, strategic side rather than the creator side. Would that be fair to say? And why did you choose that direction?
I found the direction of choosing data so much more interesting because as a creator, there's so many things you have to focus on. It's just there's too much to focus on that you never really become an expert. You become more like a jack of all trades. You become a business guy. Yeah. You become the script writer. And I just wanted to become the analyst, the guy who looks at the data and is like, there's this little pattern here that shows we have to talk a little bit differently. And now the audience is going to like us more. That is so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And just having the time for all the research, the psychology behind it all, is just so much more fun to me personally.
So you've gone into the data and the strategy. You're very much behind the scenes. You know, with a typical creator, can you look at subscriber counts or views on the channel? So where does your credibility come from? Like, can you share some success stories or case studies from your own experience?
So I have to always come back to the same case study that I really, really like. In 2020, I started working with a channel. This was one of my earlier channels. And this channel at the time pulled in about 17 million views per month. They had like a big up spike and then they went down again. And we got them to know each other. And the only thing that we did at that time is focus on retention. Because when I looked at this data, the topics looked healthy, the thumbnails looked nice. And I was like, okay, let's just optimize purely by focusing on these retention charts. We did that. So we focused on optimizing the audience experience. And within months, I think 4 or 5 months, that channel suddenly started generating like 80 million views per month. And that was so fascinating to me. And it showed me, one, the power of an audience journey. But also for me, that was also really exciting and cool because it showed that what I believed is going to work actually worked. So that was the biggest success story. I have a smaller one that I always find fun is where we needed to launch a new channel, me and a client of mine. And they wanted to launch a channel that was not having their face on it. So I had to come up with a strategy that would quickly establish social proof and establish that this is a serious channel. And by using end screens, because that was like the hack of the time, we managed to get that channel 100,000 subscribers in a single week just by resending traffic. And then initially, you know, we had a lot of views on the first video, like 1 million+. It went down and we kept on sending traffic. And eventually that channel, now the channel is sitting at hundreds of thousands, I think close to 1 million subs, can easily run by itself. So that would be one smaller, more hacky success story.
So you're talking about clients who get like 17 million views a month before you join them, or hundreds of thousands of subscribers. I guess what I'm interested in here is your first big breakthrough. It's like, imagine a channel gets its first 1,000 subscribers. Like, I guess, how did you land one of your earliest clients? Or like, why all of a sudden should I look to Mario for strategy on my channel?
This is where I unfortunately, I don't have that underdog story where I started with like a small channel. My first channel that I started on, I was very lucky to be working with a guy who had over 10 million subscribers. So this was a significant channel. The reason why I got into work with this channel is because I was, prior to YouTube, I was a little bit successful in gaming. So I was a professional gamer and I met a lot of creators at that time, you know. One of these creators that I played with, I hit him up. I was like, okay, I kind of just want to step away from this gaming. I want to do bigger things, different things. And I already learned about YouTube. And he was like, yo, you want to work for me? And I was like, listen, I want to be the best at this if I'm going to be here. And he introduced me to the best people in this industry. And I got very lucky. So unfortunately, no underdog story. But ever since then, I've just been working with the same size of people. It's been an amazing journey.
So from within a side passion, video gaming, the networks you created there gave you an entry point into YouTube, which I think in itself is like an interesting way of getting discovered. You know, like people get discovered through their videos. You got discovered through networking because you have a slightly different skill set for YouTube. Next question. Can you tell us about what you're doing right now on YouTube, like a current role or a client that you're working with within reason?
I still work with very large clients right now. So after these initial clients, I started working for the Mr. Beast team, and that was like a 2.5 year journey. And I was rather exclusive there, but then I stepped away because I wanted to get into research a lot more. I really got this drive for research. So I stepped away from the Beast team and I built my own research team, where right now I do a combination between two things. Is one, I spend time working with large clients. Like, these are typically people in a few million to higher ranges. So these are people that have more difficult problems, which I love difficult problems. And then I have a research team right now built by the most random people that haven't even spent time on YouTube. One person in my research team was a professional boxer before. So but I like taking these people from weird backgrounds, putting them together and telling them now, hey, we need to figure out thumbnails. And I don't believe everything that's out there and we don't have enough research. And now I'm giving them both a budget as well as a mission. And then I let them do their thing. And then they come back to me and they say, Mario, this is what we've learned. And sometimes that is something I already know, and sometimes that is revolutionary, I guess, where we get insights such as that the thumbnail, for example, has less importance than the idea. And those insights to me are very interesting because for creators, this is so crucial. So we take a little bit of a different approach, but that's kind of what I'm working on right now.
Did you choose to step away from working with the Mr. Beast team?
Yes. So It was a longer process, though. I think the total process took like half a year. But I think initially I worked, we did a lot of big videos. And I think the moment where it started to slowly change, like trickle in, was the Squid Game video. And I remember saying with everybody that worked on that, yeah, it's very hard to kind of top this one. And, you know, as multiple people from that team started moving on, and as 100 mil video became another 100 mil video. Eventually, I was like, what do I want to do with my life? Like, how do I want to leave a legacy behind or something? And then I was like, hey, I think I can just build something on my own. And yes, it's a big risk because people would call me crazy. Why would you step away from such a big team?
Sure.
But I thought the impact of that knowledge, I always felt it's unfair to have knowledge and have one creator benefit from this when this can be more public and more people can benefit from this one. So it's a big risk, but I mean, it turned out fine in the end, and I'm more than happy. But it was not just a single day decision. Okay, I'm out. Sure. It was a long decision for sure.
I guess it's similar in a way to YouTubers who are, you know, in quotation marks, quitting. They're not necessarily quitting. I've described it as changing. They're growing. They're adapting. They're evolving. And essentially, you know, my work here is done. What do I want to do next? And so here you are with these very intriguing tweets that you've been posting. And we here at vidIQ found one that was of particular interest to us, and we wanted to really dive into this. So you have some very forthright, I'm not going to call them opinions, but just thoughts backed up by, I assume, the data that you've done and the clients that you've worked with. And we'll get into them as we have this discussion. The first one I want to focus on is the common misconception or mistakes creators make around trying to increase views, specifically around packaging. That's something we talk about so much more these days because it's so important.
So one of the biggest things with packaging that I believed in, even when I was still working in prior teams, is I believe that the thumbnail title combo was a combo. And I believed certain things like we want to avoid text. And there was a lot of these beliefs that I have because I never had an expertise on this one. Right. And one of the first things that I did once I started building my research company was I want to know about thumbnails because I'm so focused on retention. Let me finally do this deep dive on this one. And the good thing is that I have a lot of access to people, their A-B tests with the new YouTube tools and stuff. And we have some internal tests that we've done with some test groups. So one of the big things that stood out to me is that whenever people make thumbnail changes on the A-B testing tools, sometimes we see that there is actually increase in viewership, but then the trajectory of that doesn't change much. So sometimes you'll have that. Sometimes you make a thumbnail change and the trajectory, the outlook of your video starts to change. But then it doesn't happen a lot of times. And what we also noticed was that when the thumbnail, the way it looks like, was vastly different, the same performance a lot of times happened. And that got me very interested. So I put one of my teammates, I said, I want you to investigate this stuff. And eventually we found out that there is a difference between title and thumbnail. And we found out that the thumbnail solely is there to draw attention. And the reason why this is so important to think about this is because most people think about this this intriguing painting almost. This is not a Picasso. It's a thumbnail. And a red arrow draws attention. And it's a lot simpler. But then the title, however, has a lot of weight. And that's why you often notice when you do A-B tests, when a title change is good, that can significantly change the trajectory of a video's outlook. So we started seeing an importance where the thumbnail draws attention and the title makes you decide whether you want to click or not in broad senses, right? The exact numbers are up for debate. I mean, it's easy to look deeper into research and we have to run experiments multiple times. But that's the main thing we see there, which means that we can just think for thumbnails. What are elements that are good at drawing attention? And what are title topics and title formats that are good at helping people make a decision to click? And that's the right combination rather than this back and forth and this painting observing of your thumbnails.
Can you give me maybe a specific example of a video or a channel that kind of lives and breathes this idea where like a title obviously has more impact than the thumbnail? Because, you know, most channels, it'd be like a really good thumbnail and then the title is obviously really good. But because visually we notice a thumbnail more, it's hard to pick up examples where, you know, really it's the title that sold this video as opposed to the thumbnail itself.
So I'll break this in two parts. So first of all, most people, when they think about a thumbnail, they think about the visual appeal. But if, like, how is it aesthetically pleasing? But if we take down a thumbnail, some thumbnails are aesthetically not pleasing. That doesn't mean they cannot draw attention. For example, if we take a look at Moist Critical, right? He has a very recognizable face. Some people know him, some people don't. But you see his thumbnail, visual appeal, aesthetically pleasing, absolutely 0 out of 10. It's so bad. But you recognize him. And that makes you then look at the title. And one of those titles that he had recently is another huge charity scandal. So you see his face, you recognize him through the branding, which his face is the branding. You see an intriguing title and you're like, oh, I want to hear his opinion on this thing. So that might make you click. That's one example of where aesthetically pleasing isn't necessarily the thing that draws attention. It can, but it's not necessarily needed. One example of a client that I work with, which I think is a fantastic example to explain this concept, is he had a video called I Met Ronaldo. And this is a creator called Food Crunch. It's a great title. It's a simple title, actually. But anybody can create this title. So in his thumbnail here, he puts Ronaldo's face. And that creates that interest. Oh, I see Ronaldo's face. I recognize this face. But that doesn't make you necessarily want to click just because you recognize a face. It grabs attention through recognizability, through faces. And you also recognize potentially the creator. But then you still read the title and now it says, I met Ronaldo. Oh, okay. So you see that thing that grabs your attention. You go to the title and now you're like, oh, he met Ronaldo. That creates the concept. That creates the story. It's the title of your story. And now I'm invested.
But the big question is, if, say, Moist Critical was getting 100 views per video, would people still click? But we're going to come back to that because that's one of the big topics on the tweets.
This episode of Tube Talk is brought to you by vidIQ's Competitors Tool. Checking in on what your competition is doing can be a great way to keep up with trends in your area of expertise. If you have vidIQ installed, you can find this tool on the left-hand sidebar within the YouTube studio, and from there you can begin adding channels as your competitors. I like to select a range of channels, from the ones that I find to be the leading voices in my niche, all the way down to channels that get similar views to my own. The way that this helps me personally is that I can start to actually detect patterns in the types of videos that my competitors are releasing, which helps me discover some fresh ideas that are already proven to be working. The vidIQ extension works in both Chrome and Firefox browsers, and you can download it for free at vidIQ.com.
So just thinking now more specifically about the titles, we stop the scroll. I have your attention. The title says this. What generates interest and curiosity?
Interest and curiosity are two very complex topics. And the reason why is because we often say these blank words like interest and curiosity, but they don't mean much. We say, make them curious. But I always ask myself, well, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean to engage somebody? So let's take a look at interest and curiosity as concepts and break them down on what they mean. So interest is simply that we are keen to re-experience something new or something that we're familiar with. So that is where we're looking for a tutorial on pancakes. I like pancakes. I see pancakes. I gain interest. Maybe I'm doing something new with the pancakes. Well, I gain interest. Maybe I'm just seeing, you know, how somebody makes pancakes. I want to remind myself on how these pancakes were created, right? That is interest. So interest is more subjective based on previous experiences and all those kind of things. That's how we generate interest. So sometimes we notice that our viewers like something specific and we can repeatedly make videos on that one because we know they will come back because they like to re-experience that experience. Curiosity, on the other hand, is a little bit more complex than that. So curiosity is our drive for information and more specifically, new information. So with curiosity, if we want to spark somebody's curiosity, we are looking towards one of three main factors here. So that's the drive of curiosity. We have either there's a gap in knowledge, right, that we're seeking to fill, or there is this essence of novelty, a new experience. We haven't seen this before. That could make us curious as well. And the last one is that we are presenting them with an uncertainty. So if there's some uncertainty, we could become curious to resolve this uncertainty. Those things are a little bit more practical, and I can go more in depth, such as every curiosity has strength. There's a strength to the curiosity, and there's also a motivation or a willingness for this curiosity. But basically, this is how we create curiosity. So if you want curiosity, you need something new. If you want interest, you can just remake something. But I have to say, if you have to make a choice, I advise to go to curiosity because curiosity can generate interest. Curiosity is one of the strongest ways So that novelty is one of the strongest ways actually to generate interest for a video.
I think you've just described how I discovered my break on YouTube. I was a tech channel and I did all sorts of things, reviewing apps, phones and whatever. And I just happened to make a video one day about the iPhone. And at the time, this is going back 7 or 8 years, it was really difficult to actually screen record on your phone. And obviously gamers would like to do that. And there was some, how would I describe this, unofficial ways to do it. You know, not illegal, but like just Apple makes things really hard to do if they don't do them themselves. And so I made a video on like how to record your iPhone screen. And I think that was where you just kind of described the curiosity gap. Like people understand that they can't do this, but here's a creator who's showing them how to do this. That video did really well. And then as you said, it became an interest on the channel. So I was able to make hundreds of videos on that single topic and build up an audience. And I was just having flashbacks to that moment as you were describing the difference between interest and curiosity, which is absolutely fascinating.
This is also why, you know, why one great strategy for channels that you can sometimes do is that you make 10 videos of the same topic.
Yeah.
And then people lose interest because you can only re-experience something so many times before you kind of get bored of it. But then you make that same content a year, 2 years, three, even 4 years later. And suddenly there's this revamp of interest for that specific type of video, even though they've already seen that. And that's the same as going to an amusement park. If you keep going, it gets boring. But give enough time between that last time you went, and suddenly that interest to re-experience that same thing that you've already experienced is back. Same thing happens with videos.
By the way, Mario, I love kind of like the examples and the way you turn these things into something that I'm just thinking as you say this, we can like visually put this on screen. So I'd like just keep giving us examples and stuff. It's brilliant.
I'm trying to think about the visuals.
It is fantastic. Okay. One of the, I'm going to say, I don't want to say controversial, but like one of the things that makes a lot of creators go, with your logic is you say that you believe the title has 80 to 90% more impact on the viewer's decision than the thumbnail. Defend yourself.
This is where I'm gonna have to give a little bit of leeway to the critics. So 80 to 90% is a number that grabs attention. You know, the exact number is extremely difficult to decide.
Sure.
Right. The research is still very early. That's something I have to completely admit. And there's a lot of room for improvement on the research that we've done. But the reason why I stated 90 or 80% is to have a number that sets a significance. That's not like, oh, it's a little bit more important. It's a statement from me that so far we're seeing that is significantly more important. And I'm hesitant to say that it's 100% or 60%. I wanted to just find a number that really is representative of what the current study is seeming to show. And it is still an active process. I mean, I told my team, and my team has been working on this for 6 months. I gave them another 6 months to finish their research on thumbnails. So far, we got like a document, a paper written of about 120 pages, full of information. But again, when I look at that, I say, we're not ready yet. And that's because we set a very high standard to ourselves. But I come with the statement because if I say it's so much better, people have a harder time grasping what so much better means. So that's why I made a statement 80 to 90%, even though I do believe that the significance is at that scale of importance.
So let me ask you this then. Let's say a video on the channel is like 7 of 10, 8 of 10. You're disappointed with its performance. Would you advise a creator to focus on a new title much more than a new thumbnail? I appreciate that we're kind of already way down the road here, and it could be too late in some respects. You know, the video is already, we go to the idea and like, it's the idea of it didn't work, but like title change first.
So I'm going to encourage both. So this is where, even though the title plays more of a role, it's the idea behind the title as well. The title is more than a little bit of wordplay. So what I would advise is this. If your title is a little bit messy, or it could misrepresent your idea, or there's some variation possible that could give a different image of what this video could be, I would say 1% try the title. However, since I do believe that the thumbnail is really important in grabbing the attention, so the 80-90% rule is focused on the decision, but not the attention. The attention, you still need to grab that attention. Because if you don't have that attention, well, that decision will not be made regardless. So this is where I encourage, when people make thumbnail changes, there are two main thumbnail changes that I advise first and foremost. The first one is the entire composition of your thumbnail, the way it looks and the way the elements are placed. You want to make fast differences. So one of the examples is you have a single panel layout, which is a single shot, for example, of a person. And then you have to change that to a double panel, like a before and after. These changes are significant enough that they could actually make a difference. However, what most people try with their thumbnail changes, they try, oh, I need to change my shirt from a little bit more green to a little bit more blue. Those changes are so minimal that they don't have fast differences. Add a massive red arrow or remove the massive red arrow. You know, remove an element or add a massive element. But we have to think, people don't spend more than a few seconds on your thumbnail. The intriguing details, they're not going to pay attention to. It's those big changes that can make a difference. So always think big. The second part of a thumbnail that you want to pay attention to, and that I have seen changes in the current A-B testing thumbnail tool from YouTube even, as well as all of the external parties, is changing the text in your thumbnail. I was always of the belief that text was a bad thing, but now I have found that text can be a significant difference in how people click. So yes, those few words, let's say you have a text balloon and it says, you know, this is the best idea ever. That text may actually be bad. Maybe the text that you want in that bubble is something like, wow, or unusual idea. So just some changes here is what you want to do in your text, and that can have a different outcome.
You're making me think about the analytics around decision-making just change. Like, click-through rate, we all know, is a very fluid, very unreliable metric. But what if it was like an average thumbnail view duration? Like, so, you know, if you capture somebody's attention, then they're maybe looking at it for 2 or 3 seconds. Whereas if it doesn't catch your attention, you know, the swipe goes past so quickly, it's like half a second or something. And then the click-through rate actually helps you with the actual decision being made. I know I'm going completely off topic and well into the details of this, but I'm sure you'd find that fascinating, I guess. You know, how long somebody spends actually looking at a thumbnail.
I think it is very fascinating. So this is where we're going into unicorn world, but I do sometimes believe in unicorns.
I like this.
I love unicorns. And this is one of the things, you know, one day I had this idea, hey, I want to figure out, can I increase CTR over 100%? Can I try this crazy thing with the, can I find something that stands out and is just different? And a lot of times those ideas are unicorn ideas, crazy ideas. But those ideas are sometimes the ideas that give you breakthroughs. So even if that doesn't work, I will take 50% of a unicorn. You know, I'll take a horse without the little thing up top. Right? And this is what I'm trying to say here, because that's a little bit of a visual weirdness, is what I'm trying to say is that this is amazing. And if YouTube was to be able to give us more data, because that's really the essence that we're after, we want more data.
And this useful is where data. We always want to stress data. Useful data. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is where I have to call YouTube out. And they're incredible, and people would always give them shit. And I don't believe they deserve this. They are very caring for creators. But I do believe that sometimes more useful data is good. Creators are not uploading anymore. They're analyzing. They're looking through all this data. And they're deserving of good, useful information because they will look at it. And this is, I guess this is a little bit of a, give us more data, good data, such as this specific data, I would have to think about this one. But there's many things that we can think about in terms of click-through rate for specific types of groups, or there's many things. Let's put it like that. Keep it short.
And I'm guessing, along with more data, more tools, are you both happy and frustrated that YouTube have rolling out the test and compare feature, A-B thumbnail testing, but it, you know, it only goes halfway. It it stops the scroll, but it doesn't allow you to test different ideas within the title. Is that something you would love? Or
absolutely. Or I think they can do two things better about the current A/B testing thumbnail. And when this came out, even, you know, the private A/B testing that they have going on, I think there's two things that stood out to me, and I've publicly stated this, is that the first thing is we are making a decision about these thumbnails, but we don't get CTR as a metric, right? And that one I never understood. Why do we get watch time as a metric? The thumbnail generates two things. It generates somebody clicking, and it generates somebody watching for a certain amount of time, right? Potentially. If you want us to make better decisions, we need those insights. We don't just want watch time or watch time share as a metric. Give us more specific details so we can understand, did this thumbnail make people click more, yes or no? Or did this thumbnail make people watch more? You can still say that for YouTube, we suggest this, but give us the details and we can make the decision. And then we can start talking. So that is one of the big changes. I forgot the second part of my message here, but with the title. So with titles, I think the only reason why they don't have it yet is because it's a huge effort to have this A/B testing. And that's where I feel sorry for the amount of work this will cost, but this is a must. This is an absolute must, as much as it's a must to allow people to eventually test different elements or different editing within their video, even though that's probably like 20 or 30 years out. Hopefully not.
I was going to say, expect this in 2029, this one. The crazy unicorn feature I had is, well, if you're going to measure by watch time share, allow us to drop in and out hooks. So we're allowed to edit the first. Viewers will get one of three different types of hooks, because I think that would be a better measure of watch time share if you're going to use that as the analytic. But like,
I love it.
We could go into like, we could just, all we could do is just ask for tools and never actually creating a video. So I think we've got to be very conscious of that as creators. Yes. The final question I had around the concept of a title being super important is there any exceptions to this rule whereby, you know, the thumbnail just has the greater impact and it doesn't really matter what the title says as long as it's not complete gibberish or offensive or whatever?
So in current research, it shows that there's no indication of any exceptions. But I'm going to give a but.
Yeah.
The but is when your title is a complete mess. So this is where we have to think back at 2004. No, wait, not 2004, but 2014, 2015, those type of years, right? The earlier years where everybody had a little folder and put random stuff in their thumbnails, but where also everybody started capitalizing their titles. Everything was caps. You couldn't even read it. And those days when your title is unreadable or you have like one word as a title, it still generates something, but at that point you are only left with the thumbnail. So I would be a fool to say that is not the exception to the case, but I would not advise that. That is not a solid strategy. But yes, there were people who do all caps, weird titles. You don't have a clue what they're saying, just the alphabet written or something like that. And in that case, yes, that would be an exception to the case.
Okay, we are 30 minutes in and we've covered one part of a tweet. the next conversation, what I'm trying to, you may not initially tweak here, but what we're trying to push into is the social proof has a significant impact. But I'm phrasing the question like this. What non-obvious factors influence a viewer's decision to watch a particular video?
So one of the biggest ones that I was shocked by, but it's not unexpected, was social proof. And social proof is the idea of that a video has many views, it's going to be more likely to generate more clicks. And this is something that is unfortunate for small creators and very fortunate for large creators, but we can all look at our own behavior. We open the homepage and we see a video that seems obscure, but has 3 million views. It is very tempting to click on that to see what all the fuss is about. So that's a big one. There's also video length. You know, we do make judgments based on how much time we have. But social proof is the one that always, that caught me a little bit by surprise, even though it's so obvious.
Are there any more examples you can think of beyond Moist Critical that kind of reinforce this?
So social proof in general, I don't think we have to specifically look at cases such as Moist Critical, because his stuff is more branding. And yes, there is that obscureness, but even Mr. Beast falls under this one, or any of the other large creators, right? Ryan Tran as well. They make these videos, the Penny series. This is not the first time a type of Penny series is created. I mean, he himself even has created some type of a penny to $1,000, which is a variant of that one. But if you see that, oh, this video has a million plus views or more than a million views, it's going to make you wonder. And you discover this video, now you love this video. And now you're going to want to watch more of this kind of stuff. And a smaller creator has this issue. And right now you see this. So this might be relevant only for now, but I think this experiment is going to go on for a little longer. Is if you go on the homepage, on the 5th or 6th slot, also the 11th and 12th slot, you can notice that there's videos with under 8,000 views that are like a day or 2 days old. Those videos have extremely low viewership. And when you check some of those videos days later, you notice that they've barely gained anything. And that is because when people are on the homepage, they are using that social proof part to make their decision. And if you have 500 views, unfortunately, you will not win against somebody with 500,000 views on the same topic. Because social proof shows that others have approved of this video already. So you're more likely to click there.
What experiments did you conduct to kind of discover this idea of social proof?
One question I had for one of my teammates is because I was thinking, hey, maybe I should create a channel, or maybe I should do something where I give some advice. And I asked him, how many views do I need to have until somebody takes me serious? And we ran a little bit of an experiment, and he went with it, and I didn't follow up until he came back, and he was like, Mario, I did it. I took 3 different thumbnails, right? And this was all on decorating Christmas trees. The titles were, in order to make it there, we made the titles so extremely similar. So it was all how to decorate a Christmas tree. So that we couldn't really have differences there, like, oh, I recognize this name or anything like that. So we did that as well. And then what we did is we took the views and we kind of skewed with the views. So what was fascinating in this research is that like we expected, the one with the most views, that's what people would click. But we found something interesting. One of these thumbnails stood out because it was aesthetically pleasing. It was a really good looking thumbnail. And some of the people in our experiment would actually choose that one, that video, because of the thumbnail. And that got us curious. We were like, hey, why would you, even though this has the lowest views, why would you still pick this one? And their answer was funny but simple. Oh, we didn't see the views. And once we pointed out the views, they were like, actually, now I would, this is where you could run into biases. Yeah. But now they were like, oh, we're going to conform to the norm. And we would actually pick the top one. But that part we didn't include in our conclusions too much. I just thought it was funny how they won. Oh, I didn't see the views. And then they would change just because we pointed out that the other one had more views. But it was a very fascinating little experiment that we did.
I think on April the 1st this year, what YouTube should do is just hide all view counts on all videos for 24 hours. That would be fascinating.
Just
for you.
Just change them. Just give it like a few. Like
even better,
views.
Like
just
Mr. Like Beast's latest video has 400 views. Oh, that'd be amazing. How? So thinking about this idea of social proof, how in terms of weighting, like idea, thumbnail, title, where do you think social proof fits in that line? Because you are right. Like some people will just watch a video because it's their favorite creator. You know, they kind of see the thumbnail, but maybe they don't even read the title. They just know it's, like for me, I will watch MKBHD no matter what video he makes. The topic doesn't matter. But you're saying that maybe some creators or some viewers discover new creators and videos because they're looking at the view count.
I believe, and you know, you have to think about there's 4 parts of the importance here, right? It's the abilities, the thumbnail's ability to draw attention, the title's ability to capture our interest and help us make a decision, our ability to create a great story, and social proof. And I think those are the 4 big factors. Now, if you have to rank them, it's very difficult for me to say where social proof would place. But if we look at it, and I'm going to kind of go into intuitive territory here, right? So there's not hard data on this, but I'm going to kind of put it on the second to third place. That equals with, in the decision-making process, I would say it's almost just as important as the thumbnail and the title. You know, I do say that thumbnail overall for the decision-making is less important, but it is important for grabbing attention. But I would say that social proof is on par with those things. Unfortunately, it's the one we have the least influence over.
Yeah.
But it's significant. And there is a lot of research actually around social proof that shows what humans are willing to do to conform or how they get influenced by the decision of others.
Again, I'm starting to think about views a little bit differently or comparing it to another platform. I'm thinking Amazon, like when you're looking for a product, you know, the picture probably captures your attention, then the product description. Is it like the number of stars, like 4.7, 4.8? Like, is that like equivalent of views? Like the higher it is, there's more, not social proof, but recommendation, since YouTube doesn't have likes or dislikes as prominently as they used to be.
It's the exact same thing. And actually, I'll give you a number to be more specific.
Ooh,
we noticed, because my initial experiment question was, how many views do I need for people to take me serious?
All right, this is gonna be our thumbnail. Like, Mario says you need blank number of views.
Unfortunately, it's gonna be higher than we want it to be. For educational content, this is more niche content, we're looking at 10,000 views or more before that social proof really plays a role.
Yeah.
For entertainment content, unfortunately, we're often looking at 100K plus already. It's quite significant. It's to be expected. It's not weird, but I thought maybe it's 1,000, but that 10 before that comma does so much. 1,000, we know that's a lot, but we don't grasp it's a lot. 10,000, we know it's a lot, and we can grasp it's a lot. It's the same difference between 1 million and 10 million. So the initial thing is 10,000. That's the magic number. And it sucks for small creators, but you know, now you get to your goal. And it's the same with followers, by the way. If you have if you're not on YouTube, 10,000 followers is your magic number. You want to go for as fast as you can. And it's unfortunate, but it's just research.
I guess viewer intent plays a role here, doesn't it, as well? Like if you're searching for something and you just need an answer to something, then your probably barrier to entry of a video is lower, like you say, 1,000. Yes. But if you're just browsing YouTube, like you haven't made a decision what you want to watch, you just want to be entertained, you're in a casual viewing experience, then I guess view counts are going to have more of a significant impact.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the small channel conundrum then. And I'm going to do this in two ways. First of all, I want to challenge you with this. There are examples of channels who get hundreds of thousands of views on their very first video. So they have no social proof whatsoever, and yet they've somehow, you know, beat the algorithm. How would you explain that?
So social proof is not the only thing. That's the good thing that we know.
Okay.
And those videos eventually do benefit from social proof. So along the way, as they gain views, they will benefit from social proof. However, let's talk about the part where they get those initial views. And as far as I can tell, as far as I've seen the data, most of them, they have not bought their views. They're legit channels. I've seen some of their data. So it is a genuine thing that happens. This is where they are very well in the presentation of those videos. So often they have touched on something that they knew there was a demand for. So they've looked at something like outlier theory, where you look at which videos in general score better than the other videos on a particular channel. That type of topic could spark curiosity. They also, what they're doing is the way they understand how to structure their video, whether that's intuitively or through research, actually, they're really good at presenting their story very well. So these are just often people that are just good at what they do. And if they're not good at what they do, because there are cases where a channel, like some random kid, for example, wants to get some famous person's attention, and that happens to blow up. It is just because people start to be interested in it, and they're like, what can we create? They see other people support this, and it becomes this rolling ball of other people seeing other people do things, and quickly it starts rising up. But these channels, they are, a lot of these people behind these channels, they're not, they're very knowledgeable people and they know some stuff. There are cases where they're not, but yeah. I know some of these and I can give them credit where they are due.
The reason I ask you that question is because we did a case study on a channel that had never made a YouTube video before. But what they did is they'd done a lot of research prior to making their first video, and they identified, as niche as this sounds, that YouTube was underserved for space simulator video games from the 1990s. So, like, there's lots of massive video essays on, like, Super Mario World, Street Fighter, an hour long. So they decided to do a three-hour video essay on Wing Commander. You know, it's back in the 1990s. And I think that game only sold 250,000 copies. The video did, like, 29 views on its first day, but it was a three-hour video, so it got some nice watch time. And then I think about 2 months after it launched, it started to build up a momentum. And like it, then all of a sudden, I think YouTube went through every single potential person on YouTube who might be interested in a Wing Commander video essay. And it got 100,000 views.
Yeah.
And then they did another video essay, which is even longer, on X-Wing. So slightly more popular video game on the same topic. And it took that video like less than half the time to get the 100,000 views. So, you know, that's just evidence there that, as you say, if a person is very knowledgeable and understands, I guess, the audience aspect of it, they can succeed even if they don't have that social proof to begin with. But if, kind of like following on from this question a little bit more, Mario, like, are there any easy, simple, quick hacks for social proof for small channels?
There is one hack. Like, there's actually a few hacks. So let's talk about the clickability social proof hack. And this is where what you can do is, this depends on whether you have budget or not. So unfortunately, this is a budget-related advice hack. But you can promote your own videos, spend some money, target that well, and now your video has views. Unfortunately, these are dead views, but you can do that through the promote function on YouTube themselves, or you can do that through Google Ads. There is a creator, and I am blanking on the name, but this creator has had a full breakdown on the cost of all these things. He's done an amazing analysis there on this one, and he found that for a few $100s, you can get yourself to certain thousands of views. So that is one hacky way that is an expensive hacky way. For the smaller channels, though, this is where you have to, where you can use social proof not to cheat your views, unfortunately, because that is difficult. But for smaller channels, you can still use social proof within your videos. And this is great because, unfortunately, it doesn't help as much to grab attention, but it does help to give you credibility. For educational channels, this is often when you quote research. And this shows you that you are, whatever you're saying has been approved by others. And that gives you credibility. So that's one thing for educational. For entertainment channels, it would be a little different. So if you happen to have one video with decent amount of views, what you can do is, like, you can make a reference to that video and then pop it out with the views visual. So people say, oh, this creator has actually had some popular videos. And that gives you a little bit more credit or social proof that this creator I'm watching right now is not just a nobody. He actually has done something. And with nobody, I'm referring to the amount of views here real quick, not as a bad thing. Mm.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tube Talk, brought to you by VidIQ. Head over to vidIQ.com/TubeTalk for today's show notes and previous episodes. Enjoy the rest of your video making day.